The Guardian.
World Cup Daily with James Richardson on Guardian.co.uk.
Day 15 at the World Cup. It's out with the Swiss, Honduras, North Korea and Cote d'Ivoire, and into the knockouts for Spain, Chile, Brazil and Cristiano Ronaldo FC. The pod salutes them all with a cheer and a battered phone line to call some people who can make sense of it all. There's praise for thrilling David Villa. There's pondering of England's obsession with penalties. And there's the latest on one of the natural world's biggest conundrums. Sven, how does he do it? All of that, plus your post and our little look forward to Saturday's action, USA-Ghana and, of course, Uruguay-South Korea. All of that in today's World Cup Daily. Hello, world. On board today, it's Barry Glendening.
Hello.
Hi, Barry, back again.
Yes.
And Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
Also back again. And with a donut. You're looking really happy.
I am. Producer Ben has provided us this evening with beer and donuts.
Let's earn it.
Special team. Friday evening.
Yeah. Yep, that's the team. And you, listener, you're here as well. And 48 games down, 16 to go. I say 48 games down, 48 games and a fiver down for me, Barry.
Yes.
Yes, who would have thought?
I've collected from our bet yesterday that Spain, Chile would produce more goals than Switzerland, Honduras.
Right.
You were never going to win that one, were you?
Well, it's a curious World Cup. Four games all in all today. Two of them were certifiably pants, I think.
Yes.
Statisticians agree. But before we get on to them, post of the World Cup, Bric-a-Brac says, well, nice to hear from you again, Bric-a-Brac. I don't know why there is such a fuss about all the Japanese hopes resting on one player who is named after a car. It's not just Japan that finds itself in this situation. The Netherlands, for example, are completely Robin-reliant.
Nice.
Dear. Anyway, right. Four games today. One was a cracker. Let's start with that. Spain's 2-1 win over Chile, a result which saw both teams go through, but not before Spain had been given quite a scare by Marcelo Bielsa's boys. Let's, first off, get the reaction from Goal TV Barcelona's very own Sid Lowe. 10-man Chile stole the show, Sid.
Yeah, they did. And we were talking quite a lot about this in the build-up to the game, and Spain were worried about the match against Switzerland and the extent to which teams would take a lesson from that and be very defensive. And they perhaps didn't. I'm sure that Vicente del Bosque did, but perhaps some of the media didn't appreciate the problems that can be caused in other ways by teams that pressure very high, that make it very difficult for Spain to settle. And I thought Chile was superb, and incidentally, I'm very, very pleased that Chile are through. I think if Switzerland had got through instead of them, it would have been a real pity. Not least because Chile have been better than a lot of teams that have already got through, and it was good to see them get through. But I think what Spain also did was, again, what we're talking about stylistically, the talk about keeping the ball, about the tiki-taka style, sometimes is a bit of a myth, and sometimes Spain, as they have tonight, could prove they can also play long. That said, of course, it was a terrible mistake from the goalkeeper and an absolutely brilliant finish from the guy who I'd never tire of telling you is the best striker in the world.
Well, yeah, that was an amazing move. When you talk about playing long, who was that ball upfield from that Torres tried to
I don't know who it was from, but it was Pau Torres, but it reminded me so much. If you look at the first goal that Spain scored at the European Championships, and this is my point, is people talk about the European Championships, in Spain at least, as the model of tiki-taka and the model of short passing and creating, and as if somehow it's ethically wrong to play a long ball or morally inferior to go up for a header or use your physical presence, and they forget what Spain did in the first few games in the European Championships. And tonight's goal reminded me so much of the first David Villa goal in the European Championships, which again was a long ball up the line. It was Torres fighting for it, nudging a player off and laying it into the path of Villa. Now, of course, this time he didn't lay it into the path of Villa, but it was, again, the left wing, Torres running, and Villa following him behind. And it was just a brilliant finish.
Right. David Villa looking amazing with that goal yet again. Iniesta with the second, and woof to the thought of those two playing together for Barcelona next season.
Yeah, absolutely. And Barcelona fans are very, very excited. I think they're also excited because Villa has come out of his shell a little bit in the last two games, playing on the left-hand side with a striker through the middle, which, of course, from Barcelona's point of view, makes them think, maybe we don't need to lose Zlatan Ibrahimovic now that we've signed David Villa. Maybe we can have Villa on the front of on the left of a front three, Messi sort of nominally on the right, and a striker in the middle, which would be Zlatan or maybe someone else if they were to buy someone else, which isn't necessarily that unlikely. I still think Barcelona would like another striker. So yeah, they're very, very excited about that. Look at the Spain squad. I think I'm right in saying it's seven Barcelona players. Add possibly Cesc Fabregas. Add David Villa. And you think, wow.
Wow, indeed.
Also, by the way, David Villa tonight became Spain's all-time top scorer in World Cup finals.
Wow, very impressive. Listen, what about, meantime, Fernando Torres, who the commentators here, as he was taken off, were saying, well, we may not see him again this World Cup. Is he injured? What's the story with him?
No, he's coming back from an injury. There's a feeling that Vicente Del Bosque doesn't want to push him too hard. He's trying to get him back in. And this is almost, I know this sounds ridiculous because these are World Cup games, this is almost pre-season for Torres, trying to get him going. Torres, as I think I said to you the other day, bizarrely is almost now being judged by what he does for others as much as what he does for himself. His finishing is poor, but he's helping other people. I think we saw that again today with Villa, that Villa actually suddenly looked less comfortable when he went up front on his own. He had less support. He didn't have someone to take defenders out of the way for him and offer him space. I don't think for 1 minute this is the last we've seen of Torres in the tournament. He came off, we're not sure what his physical condition is, but there's no reason to be alarmed by that as far as I understand it. Although, of course, it's still quite soon since the game ended. I don't think there's any doubt at all, unless there is an injury, that he will start the next game.
All right. And the next game is against Portugal. How big a match is that?
Massive. Although, because of the way the Spanish press handle these sort of things, I don't think Spain are playing against Portugal. I think they're playing against Cristiano Ronaldo. And only Cristiano Ronaldo. It's huge. Of course it is.
Cristiano Ronaldo has that impression as well.
Today he certainly did, didn't he? Blimey. There's a feeling in Spain now that the big thing was getting through. But as the kind of momentary, oh, thank God for that, dies away, they're now looking at the key thing, which, of course, we're all looking at, which is the games they get next. And now they're thinking, wow, it was great not just to get through, but to get through as first. Because the path isn't clear, but it's clear-ish for Spain. Portugal, who they think they're better than, although I think Portugal on the break may well be a difficult side. And then I'm right in saying it's Paraguay or Japan next to get themselves into the semi-finals. You compare that with England, who would presumably have Germany followed by Argentina, followed by Spain, followed by Brazil if they were to win the World Cup, or, let's face it, go home soon.
Right, Sid. Magnificent. Well, listen, that's fantastic stuff. Many, many thanks for joining us. And we'll be catching up with you, I hope, before the Portuguese game.
Yep, very much hope so.
Thank you, Sid.
World Cup Daily from The Guardian with James Richardson.
Sid Lowe from another Fancy Dan TV studio. What about this Chile lot then? Hey, Paolo Bandini. Who fancies them against Brazil? I've got a shiny fiver that says that...
I think you need to stop making these bets, James. Baz is looking at you with his hungry betting eyes.
But Chile looked very, very good, bearing in mind they played the bulk of that game in 10 minutes.
Yeah, but the problem is the Chile are going to continue to have, as good as they are, and they're fantastic to watch, they're going to continue to play games on 10 men. They've already got some players suspended for this game against Brazil if they're going to continue to play, you know, in the physical way that they play. And, I think Rob was making the point before that whilst the sending off in itself could be deemed harsh because he only sort of caught Torres's heels as he was stepping into the area, actually, he could have gone about 5 minutes earlier for a foul he made on Iniesta about halfway inside his own half. So, they play a certain way. It's very enjoyable to watch, but I fear they're going to shoot themselves in the foot. And I think against a team like Brazil, they're going to need to be far more ruthless with taking their chances, because in every game so far, if there's been one consistent theme with Chile, it's they don't take the chances they create.
Yeah. Do you think they're more physical than, say, England?
It's a different kind of physicality, because they haven't got that sort of bustling about in their own area defensive way that, you know, John Terry was showing off in that game against Slovenia, where he's sort of throwing himself at everything. And, you know, certainly they're not physical in the right way on crosses and corners. There was one situation early in the first half where it looked like PK and Puyol were both queuing up to put it in, and neither of them managed it. But I don't know. It's a different kind of physical, but they certainly they're not afraid to stick the boot in.
Mm. All right. Well, earlier on Friday, Brazil faced Portugal in possibly the worst game of the World Cup so far, certainly as regards expectations of the match. Let's get the view of Fernando Duarte.
Hey, Jembo, how are you, mate?
I'm very well. How are you on the mean streets of Durban?
Well, I'm fine. I'm pretty much disappointed with the horrendous quality of the spectacle today, but at least Brazil avoided Spain in the round of 16, and, you know, I think that's going to spare the World Cup of an early knockout of one of the favourites, so let's look at the bright side.
Right. The less bright side being the game this afternoon against Portugal. A lot of boos from the crowd, unusually enough, for a Brazil game. This was the first match not involving the host nation that had been a sellout, and a lot of people very unhappy with the amount of effort being put in by both teams. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I totally agree, and I totally think that some people might have fallen asleep in the second half, to be honest.
What do you think about the game? Was it just a case of neither team wanted to risk anything, or Brazil without Kaká and Alano are a seriously weakened side?
That's a bit of both, James. I think both sides are pretty much relaxed because they had already qualified. I don't think they could arrange the draw because nobody could know what was going to happen in the decisive round of Group H. But it was pretty much evident that both teams were actually just trying not to complicate themselves. As for the Brazilian problems, I mean, I've been talking about these problems for ages. There isn't a solution. There isn't a B plan. Once Kaká is out, Brazil is going to lack creativity. Is going to lack incisiveness, whatever this word exists or not. It shows that it's pretty much a mediocre team without Kaká and without Robinho.
That said, though, Fernando, I mean, this kind of game in the last match of their group stage is not unusual for Brazil. In 2002, before you were champions, didn't you lose the last group game against Turkey or something crazy?
Well, still, it's important that the team shows up, you know, that they actually try to create some stuff. I think it's psychologically important for the players as well to be able to perform without these guys. And every time we're in this situation, something wrong happens, and I'm pretty much upset with the result, to be honest.
All right. Listen, lastly, Fernando, how concerned are you and how concerned will Brazil be about Chile?
Well, Chile did a very good job in the South American qualifiers. They finished second place. Under Bielsa, they have been reborn. They're kind of like weird phoenix from the Andean region. However, they're going to be pretty much depleted for this game. And they lost their centre-backs, and that pretty much kind of took a bit of this team, I think. Still, this World Cup's pretty much crazy, and they'll be gagging to beat Brazil. And it's a fantastic scalp for them to have in their collection. Remember that Chile hasn't done anything particularly impressive in the World Cup since finishing third at their home World Cup. They'll be looking forward pretty much to actually try to cause an upset. If there was another story, well, I don't think Brazil should be concerned. However, if they take the foot off the pedal, they might get surprised. The way things are happening in this World Cup, you cannot take anything for granted. And I'm ashamed to say that as a Brazilian, but we should take this match very seriously.
Ah, lovely Fernando Duarte there. Barry?
Yes.
Did you not have a joke that you were itching to spring upon an unsuspecting pod listenership?
Well, no, I just, my mate Rosser texted me a good joke today from all the way from Hong Kong.
Ah.
To Paddy and his wife, they're married 20 years, and she's never, ever had an orgasm. So they decide to go to the doctor to see if he can do something about it, right? And the doctor examines him and her and goes, I don't know, maybe you're too hot in the bedroom. So you need to buy a fan. Paddy obviously is too tight to buy a fan. So instead, next time they're at it, he gets his friend to come around and just waft a towel at the end of the bed to keep them cool. So he's working away on his wife, nothing happening. So his friend chips in with a suggestion. He says, Paddy, why don't we swap positions and I'll have a go on your wife and you do the towel. So Paddy says, okay, we'll give it a go. And his friend clambers aboard, and within 10 minutes, his wife is screaming away in ecstasy. And eventually, you know, reaches climax, it's fantastic. And her and Paddy's mate are, you know, sitting back in bed having a cigarette. And Paddy comes up and goes, now that, my friend, is how you waft a towel.
Can I just say, that has to be the longest text message I've ever heard.
Yeah. Ah, dear. Good. There you go. Fernando Duarte, lovely fella.
I should add, Paddy and his mate were football fans, and that's why it's relevant to this pod.
Fernando Duarte, lovely fellow. The other Group H game, Barry, Switzerland-Honduras.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If I seem a bit subdued this evening, that's because I had to do the minute-by-minute report in that game. Jonathan Wilson would have had a big bulge in his trousers watching Switzerland 0, Honduras 0. For the first 70 minutes, it was absolutely appalling.
And then it got worse.
It didn't get worse. The both teams started to go for it towards the end. Switzerland needed to win 2-0 at that stage. In running, they needed to score two goals to beat Chile into second place. Honduras were playing for pride. So they started creating a few chances. Aaron Derdiok, the Swiss striker, he's the Mario Gomez of this tournament, and he missed several chances. I think he's a bit of a coward, actually. There was one chance that he could have gone in with his head.
Right.
And in a bid to score and chose not to.
I think Yakubu might be the Mario Gomez of this tournament, though.
Well, Yakubu didn't miss as many... Yakubu scored a goal.
Yeah.
And admittedly, he did have a terrible miss, but for consistent uselessness in front of goal, Derdiok was,
I think,
takes the prize so far.
Lovely. Also, a special game on Friday in Group G. Ivory Coast took on North Korea. Victory for Didier Drogba and co. But they didn't go through. But plenty for Sven to be working on then as he builds this team towards the next African Cup of Nations, eh?
Yeah, I'm sure he'll enjoy that process and he'll be around for all of it. I think we've already talked about the fact that Ivory Coast's biggest mistake, and they were unfortunate with the way the order of games went, was that they needed to beat Portugal and they didn't. Although I do also think, having watched, from what I've seen in this tournament, I can't understand why they didn't start Jovinho against Brazil, because he looks to me like he's been sort of their best player in every game. And I don't know, even in that game, it seemed like when he came on, he was sort of the thrust. But at the same time, I think they would have lost Brazil anyway. So,
yeah.
So, were you being sarcastic there about Sven?
What on earth leads you to think that he won't be changing jobs for a fat check very, very soon?
But I thought he was just contracted for the World Cup and that he was getting his $2 million to steer them out.
That's my own ignorance then. Yes, you're absolutely right. No, I'm pretty sure you're right. It was a contract for the $2 million.
In which case, do you think he might, still have a job in him before this cup's over? Do you think maybe there's someone else out there he can sidle up to advisory role?
Do you think, I have this vision of, like, Sven goes back to his hotel room each night, just closes the door, and then does, like, a Henman-esque fist pump, going, yes! And he was saying today that, like, the Ivory Coast smiled more than any team he's ever managed before. I'd say their smiles are nothing compared to his in the privacy of his own room as he goes online to check his bank balance.
It's an extraordinary...
has he made some Faustian pact with the devil?
I don't know.
That inept and make so much money from being pretty poor at your job?
Well... In industry, there's probably a lot of people like that. We just happen to see his work a lot more than we do certain, captains of big business. I don't know. Lovely fellow, though. So anyway, there you go. Group stage is over. And last 16 like this, Uruguay take on South Korea. USA, Ghana. Winners play each other. Brazil play Chile. Holland play Slovakia. Winners play each other. Argentina play Mexico. Who play the winners of Germany and England. And Spain play Portugal, who will play the winners of Paraguay and Japan. All very interesting. England, Barry. England against Germany.
Yeah.
Which already in England, in the UK, has become all about penalties. Are we ready for penalties? Have we practiced penalties? Capello's already named his five penalty takers. They haven't even played the game yet. They haven't even drawn at the end of 90 minutes or drawn at the end of extra time. And already... The country's fixated on penalties. Why?
I don't know.
I think I do. If you say to people, do you think we can beat Germany? They'll say, I'm not sure if I can. But if you say, do you think that this time, when we play Germany and we get penalties, we might beat them? You think, yeah. This, like suckers at the casino, you think, this time our numbers got to come up. And casting it as a football match is a bit depressing, comparing it to casting it as some new chapter in this national narrative of our epic quest to defeat the Germans. When you cast it in that light and ignore the fact that there's actually a football match, but you make it all about our eternal quest to beat the Germans at penalties.
Well, I mean, the bookies, who don't get a whole lot wrong, to be fair, have just over 9-1 or 8-1 for Germany to win on penalties, just over 8-1 on England to win on penalties.
It goes to penalties.
Yeah, well, it has to go to penalties for one of them to win on penalties.
Right, sure. But presumably the likelihood is it's not going to go anywhere near that.
It might. It might. The odds are probably available for it to go to penalties. I don't know what they are, but I have a feeling in my bones, and there isn't a great deal of evidence to support it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not grounded in logic, right? Yeah. But I do actually think England are going to prevail this time.
Right. With penalties or not, Barry?
Don't know.
See, I'm obsessed by them.
I wouldn't back England to win a shootout. And, I mean, all this talk of penalties is just going to heap more and more pressure on the players.
Yeah.
Germany have already missed their penalty. In this World Cup, they're unlikely to miss another, are they?
Well,
I sort of came in here sort of thinking, oh, I'm going to have to go up against Baz on this one because I thought you were going to be damning England again. But actually, I agree with you. And I can't really give you a good reason other than that I think that Germany, you know, there's this great national, issue in our psyche. They're viewed as a certain thing that they just aren't this year. You know, they're a young team who are reasonably frail at the back and who aren't necessarily anything special. They've got some good players. Ozil's obviously having a fantastic tournament, but I don't think that they're necessarily coming into this showing the sort of form that should make you think that England can't be.
What, like England are?
No, but the point is that, you know,
Germany have at least had one good performance. And I know Australia were down to 10 men, but even before they had a man sent off, Germany were all over them. England haven't yet looked like they were really dominating a football match, and that might well change. Certainly momentum does seem to be far more with England than it is with Germany, whose performances, to the untutored eye, appear to be getting progressively worse. However, we'll have the opportunity to discuss this much, much more tomorrow. Barry, you wanted to throw
I just think this England team on their day could beat Germany, but how often does this England team have their day? You know, they've been poor so far in this tournament. I think some people are getting a bit overexcited about their win over Slovenia, which I thought, again, was a pretty poor performance. But they have to deliver at some point, don't
they? Well, you'd think so, but did anyone see that brilliant YouTube thing from Spanish TV? They had a camera. Now, this is what to be fair, English TV really should have been doing this. But anyway, the Spaniards stuck a camera on Capello and put subtitles on for the benefit of their non-Anglophone viewers. And it's absolutely brilliant viewing. If you haven't seen it, I really recommend it. Him going bonkers and screaming above all at Gareth Barry. With quite saucy English language.
I quite like the bit with Stuart Pearce.
Yeah.
Because Stuart Pearce sort of sits down next to him and he goes, "Have you sat down already?" And he goes, "Yes." And he goes, "Well, get up again." And sort of shoves him off the end of the bench. Now, it's a bizarre moment.
He stands up, probably because he was sick of being banged and knocked by Capello in all his wild exhortations. So Capello notices this after a bit and he says, "Hey, sit down." And then as soon as he sat down, he said, "Did you just stand up?" Stuart Pearce says, "Yeah." He says, "So I'll stand up then." So he was Stuart Pearce.
But he
jumps to his feet.
He doesn't just point. He literally pushes him off the side of the bench. I mean, I imagine that they didn't show on English TV because it would be too much English psyche to see our hard man Psycho getting bullied by a leather faced aging Italian.
But, yeah, indeed. Well, there you go. Anyway, now, posts. The GAF has a soft spot for Asian nations. They make very few fouls, don't complain, and dispute refereeing decisions. They just get on with it and play good football. And another stunning performance, Keisuke Honda. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Only Italy, lovely long post from you. I like that quote you've got from La Repubblica. Vittorio Zicconi writing there on Friday morning saying, "Lippi is a man who won at the roulette once and thought he was good rather than lucky. He then bet everything on the same number and lost." Very nicely encapsulated there. Bingo the dog wants to know what happened to Sebastian Giovinco. He didn't grow. Paolo, is that probably the summary?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a case made that Juventus haven't used him correctly, but he's very lightweight. And he, in the same way as Theo Walcott hasn't really managed to work out how to impose himself on a game, but more so, he sort of hasn't worked out how to turn that speed and sense of trickery into something concrete.
Interesting. Bronwyn 99 agrees with Barry.
Hooray. On what?
On the fact that it doesn't matter if USA care if they have a national team that plays football and stuff like that. I'm not sure if it's nicer when they care, because that way, you know, if you beat them, makes it a bit more special if they actually care about it.
I think that's bang on. I think the reason America wind everyone up so much is because it feels like if they win, they'll gloat about it, but if they lose, they won't care, and that's what bothers people.
Soft, strong, and very, very long. This is World Cup Daily with James Richardson.
Now, Saturday, USA will be playing Ghana, of course. It's called the Revenge in Rustenburg, because, of course, it was the Black Stars who denied USA the chance of getting out of the groups in 2006, in the last group match. But there you go. USA arriving in on a bit of a high after that last-minute Landon Donovan goal against Algeria. Barack Obama has tipped them to go through to the quarterfinals.
Well, that's a given then, isn't it?
Yeah. But there you go. They're taking on Ghana.
Imagine if Barack Obama tipped Ghana. Imagine if he'd gone, he'd been asked, and he'd go, nah, I think Ghana will win that game. And then given a really long explanation as to why, really tactical insight, savvy, as to why he thought, you know, oh, they'll overrun us in midfield, attack our left back, and, you know. I'd have been impressed.
Dimension. But yes, Ghana, you know, tactically, there's a lot of pointers that suggest this might be. Yeah, they got through in 2006 and were faced immediately by Brazil and got biffed. This time around, they might fancy their chances, no?
Am I right that that both their goals have been penalties?
They haven't scored from open play, yeah. That is true. But they created loads against Germany, you know?
Yeah. I think that bothered me, though, that they created all that and couldn't score. Mm. But
All right. Well, they've got a bit of a track record of success. Their youth team won the FIFA Under 20 World Cup late last year. They finished second in the Africa Cup of Nations, so there's momentum behind them as well, isn't there?
According to the Guardian's match pointers,
oh yeah,
if USA beat Ghana, it would be the first time since 1930 that the American team have won two consecutive World Cup matches.
Is that so?
According to the Guardian. But, you know, can you really trust that publication?
So they won two in a row in 1930?
Apparently. I'm afraid my knowledge of World Cups does not stretch back far enough to tell you.
Well, that's a remarkable statistic. Ghana, sadly, will have a severely reduced support for this game. About 1,000 Ghanaian fans who were sent to South Africa by the government to cheer the national team on have now been sent home despite the team qualifying for budgetary reasons. The Ghanaian government said that they didn't plan for the expense of having fans actually staying on past the group stage. It's a bit of a shame, isn't it? It's a lovely idea, those subsidised fans being kind of bussed out to matches.
Yeah, they could have done with some at the Switzerland-Honduras match because the stadium was half empty.
Oh.
But I think FIFA offered the tickets to poor African kids, and the African kids saw that Switzerland were playing and said, no thanks, we'd rather stay at home.
Yeah. Okay, in the other last 16 match, Uruguay are taking on South Korea. Now, there's been lots of love for Uruguay, who after a slow start against France have, I think, evolved into one of the most impressive sides we've seen in these group stages. Tight at the back, ever so exciting going forward.
Well organised.
Well, one of the Guardian's fan network fellows, our Uruguay correspondent, has actually been following them around in South Africa, and we caught up with him a little bit earlier. The authentic sound of Uruguayan fans out there in the football paradise that is South Africa. And that's David Patrick Lane there from the Other Football blog. David, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Yeah, and I note from your accent that you were, what, probably conceived in Uruguayan territorial waters, is that right?
That is correct. It's a very Liverpudlian story, you know. Folks go away to sea and they do things on boats, you know.
Right, lovely. You've remained a Uruguayan fan, and you're now travelling around South Africa following the Celeste's progress, which has been very impressive so far.
It has been impressive. It's been so impressive that there's a mass exodus of Uruguayans coming from Montevideo, according to the Uruguayan papers.
Oh, really?
100 of them are coming.
Wow. Listen, the opening game wasn't very special. It didn't give much of an impression that this sleeping giant of world football, Uruguay, was about to start awakening. Forlan, brilliant as well. Forlan's just been excellent all the way through, in fact. And they're great at the back. They haven't conceded a goal yet.
Well, Diego Lugano, I mean, he's not afraid to lift world championships. He's done it with Sao Paulo, you know, and he's got the, you know, he's got the balls to do it. He's you know, he's a captain. No one in the Uruguay team is afraid of Argentina, Brazil, or anybody. We respect them. We know our limitations, but you know, we feel we can go very far and win the cup. At least I do, and several Uruguayans I know feel that way.
Right.
Having said that, a lot of Uruguayan supporters are low key. They don't want to talk it up just yet.
Yeah,
and that fits into the spirit of the Uruguayan team right now. They chose to base themselves in a place called Kimberley in the dead centre of South Africa. And the town is very similar to many provincial Uruguayan towns, like a Paysandú or a place like Salto or something like that. It's dusty parks, you know, clay car parks with their old rugby stadium in the middle where the team train. They stay in a very standard four-star hotel. They get on a charabang. They come along. They train for an hour or two and go back. They pop into the local establishments. The locals love them. You know, they haven't gone to a resort at all, you know. They're just concentrating on the football, which is a very Uruguayan thing.
Am I right in saying there's some kind of cosmic relationship between Africa and Uruguay?
There is. I mean, Uruguay was noted for introducing the first African Uruguayans into their setup, much of the distaste of some of the other more well-known South American teams like Brazil. And Isabelino Gradin was very famous in the 1916 Copa America, and Jose Andrade, another black Uruguayan, played a vital part in Uruguay winning the first World Cup. So there is a connection. It's quite symbolic, but it's important. And I was speaking to Uruguay supporters yesterday. It's important for them as well.
This is a strange World Cup. Can this small country, from what you've seen, how much does it dare to dream?
I've been in touch with friends in Montevideo, and they are daring to dream. They're talking about the 11th of July, you know, it's been almost like Christmas. They're looking forward to it. So they are thinking of the final, or thinking of winning the World Cup and bringing the cup home. It's resonating right now. I mean, I make a joke to say 100 Uruguayans are coming on a plane to Port Elizabeth tomorrow, but, you know, it's a small country, and that's a lot of people to make such a journey.
Yeah. So. David, listen, final question. How much is this all costing you?
Well, you have to sort of box clever. You know, I went to see the Uruguay team in Kimberley, where you spend 120 rands a night in a room where there's no World Cup being held. So, for example, tonight I'm spending 200 rand in a place that's sort of halfway between Port Elizabeth and Durban, that's in the Transkei, and, you know, there aren't many football supporters around here either. And the hospitality from South Africans has been fantastic. You know, one night I came to a hostel, it was full. The owner told me not to worry, that I could stay with him in his house. He was an old Afrikaner guy. He got drunk. He took me back to his place with his brother and a few friends. You know, beers were opened and gave me a sort of panoramic view of Pretoria, you know. And so that was a free night, and so on and so forth. So folks are incredibly, incredibly generous. A lady we just stayed with in Durban, you know, not a hostel or anything, just someone's house, you know, was happily there making sandwiches and a packed lunch for us to leave with when we left Durban late this afternoon. So people are throwing generosity at you, locals buying you drinks. I mean, I can't recall being in a friendlier country, to be honest. Having said that, you know, obviously I'm aware of all the potential dangers of traveling around a country that's got severe social and economic problems, but so far it's been fantastic.
Sure. David, listen, long may your journey continue. Can you just send us off with a song?
Oh, yeah. Pablo, Pablito.
Yeah.
Soy celeste.
Oh, sí, sí.
It's okay, Jimbo.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, David. Listen, really enjoyed your contribution, and have a fantastic trip. Best of luck tomorrow, yeah?
Yeah, I look forward to speaking to you from Cape Town, the semi-final before we play Brazil.
There you go, eh? Uruguay. We've liked them so far, haven't we, Paolo?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one minute I've done in this tournament was the Uruguay South Africa game, which was genuinely a really impressive showing. I think South Africa have a lot of vulnerabilities. My only concern with Uruguay is just because of the way they played in that first game against France. I think they'll be fine against South Korea. I worry that they don't back themselves enough in the big games, because really, when you see how France in the rest of the tournament, they're easily a good enough team to wipe the floor with this France side. And so the question is, when it comes to them playing against, you know, the supposedly bigger names, are they going to be willing to play in the open way that suits them best, and in the way that you know, makes the most enjoyable to watch?
Barry, have you seen much South Korea?
No. Right. They're one of few teams I haven't seen a great deal of.
All right, then. They've impressed with their fitness and passing and their organisation, but their defensive fragility has seen them concede 6 goals in the last 2 matches. Well, those are the games then on Saturday, Uruguay, South Korea and USA against Ghana. We'll be reviewing those same time tomorrow, and looking forward, of course, to Sunday's matches. Of course, England against Germany, but also Argentina, Mexico, Sean Engel, Raphael Honigstein and many, many more joining us for that. So make sure you do too. listeners. Many thanks, producer Ben, for this evening, and Barry Glendenning, and of course, Paolo Bandini. We'll be back tomorrow. Speak to you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.